This is Dr. Simopoulos, the president of the Center for Genetics, Nutrition, and Health in Washington, D.C., and I will be speaking on omega-3 fatty acids in the metabolic syndrome, diabetes, and obesity. I would like to begin with the concept of positive health. And the concept of positive health was established in the 5th century B.C. by the Hippocratic physicians, who were very much interested in prevention. In other words, although they were physicians, they were not only taking care of the sick, but they were particularly interested in maintaining health. And because the word prevention has negative connotations in Greek, they referred to it as the concept of positive health. And they defined it as a state of health that requires a knowledge of man's primary constitution, what today we would call genetics, and of the powers of various foods, both those natural to them and those resulting from human skill, today's processed food. But they recognize that eating alone is not enough for health. There must also be exercise, of which the effects must likewise be known. The combination of these two things makes regimen when proper attention is given to the season of the year, the changes of the winds, the age of the individual, and the situation of his home. They concluded that if there is any deficiency in food or exercise, the body will fall sick. In other words, they understood the importance of genetics as well as the importance of the environment, and they defined health as the interaction of our genes with various environmental factors that determines what becomes of us, and that occurs throughout development. This is a very important concept, and today I'm going to focus on omega-3 fatty acids as the nutrient and as a very important environmental factor in growth and development and in health and disease, with emphasis on the metabolic syndrome, obesity, and diabetes. It's important to recognize that major changes have taken place in our food supply. Human beings evolved on a diet that was much lower in saturated fat than is today's diet, and it was balanced in the omega-6 and omega-3 essential fatty acids, and the amount of trans fatty acid was minimal. Trans fatty acids, of course, although they occur naturally in less than 1 to 2% of energy, it is actually due to the formation of processed foods that occurs during hydrogenation. Today, it is very important to understand that the changes, the enormous increase in the omega-6 fatty acids and the much lower amount of omega-3 fatty acids leads to an extremely high omega-6 to omega-3 ratio that is not consistent with evolution. And it is not consistent with the way our genes were programmed to respond. In addition to these changes in fatty acids, we have much less amounts in our diet of vitamin E, as well as vitamin C that are very important to health, and of course vitamin D. The changes came about because of many, many factors. Primarily was the inappropriate recommendation to increase the amount of vegetable oils, which are very high in omega-6, such as corn oil, safflower, and sunflower, in order to lower cholesterol to reduce heart disease. What is very important to understand is that at that time the recommendations were made, there was not very good evidence that by using vegetable oils high in omega-6, such as corn and sunflower, that lower cholesterol automatically lowers the risk of heart disease. Also today, there are many studies that show that saturated fat is not necessarily associated with increased risk of heart disease. So a number of recommendations that have been made need to be evaluated in the light of today's knowledge and scientific research. Besides the increase in omega-6 from vegetable oils, we also have an increase of omega-6 in animal products because animals are now grain-fed and grains are high in omega-6, as well as eating much less fish and eating much less green leafy vegetables. High sources of omega-6 fatty acid are sunflower oil and safflower, corn oil, whereas sources that are high in omega-3 are the oils such as flaxseed and canola. Now, I would like to tell you a bit why we're so concerned that we have a lot of omega-6 and very little omega-3s and what happens. The omega-6 and omega-3 fatty acids are called essential fatty acids because the body cannot make them and we must get it from the diet. The parent fatty acid of the omega-6 is the linoleic acid, and the parent fatty acid of omega-3 is linolenic or alpha-linolenic. These parent fatty acids metabolize in the liver the omega-6 to arachidonic acid and the omega-3s to EPA and DHA, eicosapentaenoic acid and docosahexaenoic acid, through desaturation and elongation. The enzymes that lead to the saturation and elongation and formation of arachidonic acid and EPA and DHA are the same. So if there is a lot of omega-6 as it is in today's diet, then the pathway from omega-6 down to arachidonic acid becomes the predominant pathway, and not enough EPA and DHA is going to be formed from omega-3 because of the predominant amount of omega-6 in the diet. That's one competition level. Diseases such as diabetes and hypertension also are associated with less formation of arachidonic acid and EPA and DHA, as is aging, and premature babies do not have very active enzymes. Now, the reason we don't want to have high amounts of linoleic acid in our diet is also because if you have a lot of linoleic acid, let's say from sunflower oil or corn oil, and you want to cook fish, the linoleic acid in high amounts will interfere with incorporation of eicosapentaenoic acid by ourselves once we eat the fish. So if you're going to cook fish, please do not use linoleic acid or oils with high amounts of linoleic acid. You're better off using olive oil, for example, or a combination of olive oil and canola. Now, people have become interested for many years in evaluating the amounts of linoleic and alpha-linolenic acid during the Paleolithic period, which is the time when our genes were programmed to respond to balanced amounts of linoleic and alpha-linolenic. So during the Paleolithic period, they were balanced, or the ratio was a little bit more alpha-linolenic, whereas today's the ratio of linoleic to alpha-linolenic, instead of being less than 1, is almost 20 to 1, or to be precise, 18.75. The longer-chain fatty acids also were much lower, where today, again, the ratio is much higher. During the Paleolithic was 1.79, where today is 3.33. Overall, the ratio was less than 1 during the time that we evolved, and whereas today is very high, and we have a number of issues and concerns that have been scientifically proven that omega-6 fatty acids in high amounts, either in the form of linoleic, LA, or arachidonic acid, increase the amount of obesity and diabetes, increase the risk of heart disease, cancer, etc. So a number of studies have been done in populations around the world, and the diets that are much closer to the Paleolithic diet and the ratio was the diet of Greece prior to 1960, followed by the diet of Japan and India in the rural areas. But in the cities in India, because of the high amounts of corn oil that was used in order to increase the energy intake of the population, the ratio is very high, as it is in Northern Europe and the U.S. with a ratio of 15 for Northern Europe, 16.74. Now, a number of studies have been carried out looking at the ratio of arachidonic acid, the omega-6, to EPA, the omega-3s, in various populations around the world, such as Europe and the United States, Japan, and Greenland Eskimos. Of course, Greenland Eskimos, they eat a lot of fish and whale blubber. They have the lowest ratio of omega-6 to omega-3. It's balanced one. And they have the lowest rate of cardiovascular mortality, about 7%, where in the U.S., with a ratio of 50, they have a mortality rate of 45. In Japan, with a ratio of omega-6 to omega-3 of 12, they have a mortality rate of 12%. In the population in India, there is evidence that there is genetic predisposition for the development of abdominal obesity, metabolic syndrome, and diabetes. And as the amount of omega-6 fatty acids in their diet increased, so did the percent of diabetes in the population. For example, the prevalence of diabetes in the rural population, where the ratio is balanced, is about 1 to 2%, whereas as the ratio increased because of the high amounts of corn oil in the diet, the corn oil has a ratio of about 66 to 1, the diabetes prevalence increased enormously from 1 to 2 to about 7%. In addition to looking at the relationship of the ratio to diabetes, a number of studies have been carried out in many of the chronic diseases, and I will come to that towards the very end of my presentation. But I would like to point out that one of the major complications of diabetes, of course, is kidney disease, and as the ratio of omega-6 to omega-3 in the diet increased, it appears to be associated with both worsening of the inflammation over time as well as a trend toward higher death risk in hemodialysis patients. And additional studies, including interventional trials, are needed to examine these associations in relationship to the clinical outcome, but in terms of the severity and death rate in hemodialysis patients, the higher the ratio, the higher the death rate. Another disease that is very common, and the studies were done in Japan, but there are also studies in other parts of the world, is periodontal disease. Periodontal disease, of course, is associated with cardiovascular disease because the infection that causes periodontal disease may also cause inflammation and infection and the development of cardiovascular disease. Again, the higher the ratio of omega-6 to omega-3, the higher the number of the complications of the periodontal disease. Now, in terms of the experimental evidence of what happens when you change the ratio of omega-6 to omega-3, I would like to describe to you the studies that are done by Dr. Khan at Harvard. What he did is the following. As I mentioned earlier, the body cannot make omega-6 and omega-3 fatty acids, and we must get it from our diet. Also, the body, humans and other mammals, cannot make omega-3s from omega-6, where the plants can. But mammals and humans cannot make omega-3 from omega-6 because we lack the enzyme, the delta-3 desaturase. So what Dr. Khan did is he took this enzyme from the C. elegans, which is a worm, and put it into first into cardiac cells, and then did it with now the whole animal. He did it with rodents and then with pigs. So this event where you put the omega-3 desaturase into the cell cultures that are being fed, so to speak, omega-6, the culture cells are going to make omega-3s from omega-6. So they make alpha-linolenic from linoleic, and then they will make EPA from arachidonic acid, and then they will make DHA from DPA omega-6. So this occurs, and this conversion does not stop until the ratio of omega-6 to omega-3 is about 0.9, which is very similar to the ratio we found in the people in Crete. So the animal then that is fed a standard diet and then is given the gene that has the delta-3 desaturase, that animal then has a balanced ratio of omega-6 to omega-3 fatty acids. And when you do studies on these animals, you find out that these animals do not develop heart disease. If you transfer a tumor into their body, it does not become cancerous. They have a much decreased rate of cancer, and they also have a much lower risk for developing diabetes and obesity and stroke. So these are very important experimental studies that show the importance of the ratio relative to the development of chronic diseases. Now, I would like to tell you a little bit more about the metabolism of the omega-6 and omega-3 fatty acids. And we said that the 18-2 linoleic acid and 18-3, the omega-3 alpha-linolenic acid, they give rise to arachidonic acid, the omega-6, and to eicosapentaenoic acid, the omega-3. These two fatty acids, the arachidonic acid and the eicosapentaenoic acid, are the parent compounds for the development of prostaglandins and leukotrienes, commonly called eicosanoids. Eicosi in Greek means 20 because they have 20 carbon atoms. And the compounds that are developed from arachidonic acid and those from EPA are distinct, have opposing properties. They are physiologically very important. Those from arachidonic acid are pro vasoconstrictive, and they raise the blood pressure, where those from the EPA are less so. They dilate the blood vessels, and from the arachidonic acid at the level of the neutrophil, they are very pro-inflammatory, where those from EPA are less inflammatory. So you can think of the omega-6 as being prothrombotic, pro-inflammatory, those of omega-3 being less so. So once you have a balance, the body is in harmony. In addition to those compounds made from EPA and DHA, EPA and DHA, they make what are called additional compounds, lipid mediators that are involved in inflammation. And those from EPA are called resolvins of the E-series. Those from DHA are the resolvins of the D-series. Also, the DHA is making the protectin D, which is a neuroprotectant, very important in the brain. And arachidonic acid makes lipoxins A4 and B4. So the omega-3 fatty acids then are very important in modulating the immune system and in decreasing inflammation. And they have the ability to lower interleukin and tumor necrosis factor, both of which are very important and very pro-inflammatory and also pro-thrombotic. And they're increased in all of the chronic diseases. In addition, omega-3 fatty acids lower interleukin-6, which is a pro-inflammatory cytokine, and it increases C-reactive protein and fibrinogen. And again, is the interleukin-6 is increased in many of the chronic diseases, and the omega-3 fatty acids have the ability to lower all these pro-inflammatory cytokines. And interleukin 1 is a cytokine that affects every part in the body. So the omega-3 fatty acids have the ability to lower it and keep it more or less in check. Many of the chronic inflammatory diseases that we're concerned about today in our societies, such as rheumatoid arthritis, ulcerative colitis, psoriasis, lupus, diabetes, obesity, atherosclerosis, and cancer, are characterized by high amounts of interleukin 1 and tumor necrosis factor, as well as interleukin 6. And the omega-3 fatty acids are the most potent nutrients that lower them. So I would like to now move on to the metabolic syndrome. The prevalence of metabolic syndrome in the United States has been increasing and is particularly high for older adults and certain ethnic groups. Hispanics have the highest reported prevalence of metabolic syndrome and are more likely to be affected by type 2 diabetes than non-Hispanic whites. The metabolic syndrome is associated with an increased risk of type 2 diabetes mellitus and cardiovascular disease. Now, there have been a number of definitions of the metabolic syndrome, and the one that is the most commonly accepted is the one which is characterized by abdominal obesity, where the waist circumference is more than 102 centimeters in men or more than 88 centimeters in women. Now, omega-3 fatty acids have the ability to lower abdominal obesity, and I'll come back to that later. A second component of the metabolic syndrome is dyslipidemia, which means high triglycerides and low HDL. By that, we mean high triglycerides more than 150 milligrams per deciliter, and a decrease in HDL to less than 40 in men and less than 50 milligrams in women. Omega-3 fatty acids are the most potent substances that lower triglycerides. Triglycerides cause serious problems because they are increased in fatty liver, and they are also a risk factor for cardiovascular disease. In addition to lowering the triglycerides, in some individuals, the omega-3 fatty acids may raise the HDL. The third component of the metabolic syndrome is high blood pressure, which is defined more than systolic 130 over diastolic 85. And the omega-3 fatty acids, again, they have the ability to lower blood pressure. The fourth component is fasting hyperglycemia, which means a blood sugar level more than 100 milligrams per deciliter. The omega-3 fatty acids, they decrease insulin resistance and they increase insulin sensitivity. Both of these lead to a much normal blood sugar level. Now, when people do studies, they usually look at the physiologic aspects of the development of disease. For example, we look at family history or look at the genes and then consider the phenotype. In other words, are we looking at a person who has high blood pressure or is obese or has diabetes? And the number of studies that follow then, they are looking at the interaction between genes and nutrients or other aspects of the environment, such as diet, calories, lipids, physical activity, stress, drugs, etc. It is important to understand the development and the progression of the metabolic syndrome, because a person may have a family history of obesity, but today, of course, you don't even need to worry about a family history, since the majority of the U.S. population is obese. So obesity in the family occurs under situations where there is increased energy intake, decreased energy expenditure, and a sensitive genotype that leads to propensity to increasing body weight, and that's followed by insulin resistance and glucose intolerance, which then leads to the metabolic syndrome, and the final outcome is diabetes mellitus. So that all these three situations, either the metabolic syndrome, obesity, or diabetes, are all interrelated, and the omega-3 fatty acids have beneficial effects because they have the ability to lower the various risk factors that are associated with it. Let me describe for you a study in a group of patients who were obese and hypertensive. So these individuals were followed for 16 weeks, and one group stayed on their regular diet, and the second group took omega-3 fatty acids. The third group went on a weight loss diet, and the fourth group went both on a weight loss diet as well as taking omega-3 fatty acids, about 3 grams a day of EPA and DHA. And the group that had the lower blood pressure was the group where both weight loss and fish oil were taken by these individuals. And in addition to lowering the blood pressure, they also lost more weight, and they stabilized their glucose metabolism and insulin sensitivity. So in addition to the animal studies, there are a number of very good clinical metabolic studies, and of course, there are very good epidemiological studies. Now, one of the many problems that has occurred and is increasing rapidly, in addition to the metabolic syndrome, is non-alcoholic liver disease. This is called steatosis, and the prevalence of metabolic syndrome is currently 22%, and that of non-alcoholic fatty liver disease is 20%, supporting the notion that non-alcoholic fatty liver disease is the hepatic manifestation of the metabolic syndrome. So the study I'm going to tell you about was done in rodents, and for that they used the omega-3 fatty acids as well as the resolvin, which is one of the lipid mediators produced by omega-3 fatty acids. And what they found out is that the omega-3 fatty acids, they upregulate the expression of insulin-sensitizing genes in adipose tissue. In other words, they increase the production of what is called PPAR gamma, and they also increase the production of insulin receptor, and they increase the production of GLUT4, which is the gene that actually helps in the absorption of sugar from the bloodstream into the cell. And in addition of bringing about these changes in the adipose tissue, they brought about similar changes in the liver, which is a very important finding because it is for the first time that they have been able to show that all these findings emphasize the fact that you can decrease the fatty liver and you can decrease the inflammatory liver injury. And this provides a strong rationale for dietary supplementation with omega-3 fatty acids in patients with liver disease. And this could have a very beneficial potential implication for the use of marginal steatotic liver donors, which are currently excluded because of the presence of microvesicular steatosis. So this is a very important study and one that needs to be considered very seriously for the benefit of the patients because there are a lot of people who are waiting for liver transplants. So what I'm saying is that if there are donors who have small amount of liver steatosis, you can give them omega-3 fatty acids, get rid of the liver, the fatty liver, and then he can be a donor for a patient who needs liver. So let me summarize. The omega-6, omega-3 ratio and its importance in chronic diseases, because I didn't have time to cover a lot of diseases, but I want to summarize it for you. For example, in the secondary prevention of cardiovascular disease, a ratio of 4 to 1 was associated with a 70% decrease in total mortality. A ratio of 2.5 to 1 reduced rectal cell proliferation in patients with colorectal cancer, whereas a ratio of 4 to 1 with the same amount of omega-3 PUFA had no effect. The lower omega-6 to omega-3 ratio in women with breast cancer was associated with decreased risk, and there are now a number of clinical studies that they show that. A ratio of 2 to 3 to 1 suppressed inflammation in patients with rheumatoid arthritis, and a ratio of 5 to 1 had a beneficial effect on patients with asthma, whereas a ratio of 10 to 1 had adverse consequences. These studies indicate that the optimal ratio may vary with the disease under consideration. This is consistent with the fact that chronic diseases are multigenic and multifactorial. Therefore, it is quite possible that the therapeutic dose of omega-3 fatty acids will depend on the degree of severity of disease resulting from the genetic predisposition. Now, today, our society is characterized by increased amounts of omega-6 fatty acids, obesity, and definitely a lifestyle that is one where there is a lack of exercise. And if you remember, the Hippocratic physician said if there is a lack of food or exercise, the body will fall sick. Well, today we have lack of omega-3s and lack of exercise. And it's interesting because the omega-3 fatty acids and exercise have exactly the same beneficial effects in human beings. For example, they both increase metabolic rate, they increase insulin sensitivity, where they lower fat mass, they lower blood pressure, they lower fibrinogen, they lower platelet aggregation, they lower plasma viscosity, they lower arrhythmias, they improve nitric oxide, they lower depression. And it's interesting that exercise in subjects, both in human studies as well as animal, but particularly normal volunteers, it increases the incorporation of DHA both in the brain as well as in the muscle. And there are a number of people now that are looking specifically as to the effects of omega-3 fatty acids on the part of the brain that is called hippocampus, where there are insulin receptors and where it has been shown that omega-3 fatty acids, they improve memory as well as learning. And now there is a group of investigators that are studying the metabolic syndrome in the brain. Similarly, the effects of omega-3 fatty acids and exercise, they decrease the rate of the aging process. Both of them decrease the aging as well as fat mass, where fat mass increases with aging. With aging, the metabolic rate goes down, where omega-3s and exercise increase. They improve lean body mass. They improve lean sensitivity. Insulin sensitivity is decreasing with aging, so omega-3 fatty acids are very important. So what can we conclude about my presentation to you today? Western diets are characterized by high omega-6 and low omega-3 fatty acid intake, whereas during the Paleolithic period, when humans' genetic profile was established, there was a balance between omega-6 and omega-3 fatty acids. Therefore, humans today live in a nutritional environment that differs from that for which our genetic constitution was selected. Although a number of mechanisms have been considered, a major benefit of EPA and DHA in neurodegenerative diseases may be their anti-inflammatory properties and their ability to influence the expression of genes beneficial to health. The balance of omega-6 and omega-3 fatty acids is important for homeostasis and normal development throughout the life cycle. A lower ratio of omega-6 to omega-3 fatty acids is more desirable in reducing the risk of many of the chronic diseases of high prevalence in Western societies, as well as in the developing countries. The scientific basis for the development of a public policy to develop dietary recommendations for essential fatty acids, including a balanced omega-6 to omega-3 ratio, is robust. In other words, it's strong. Now, let me tell you a little bit about what is considered adequate intake and dietary recommendations, because we had a workshop at the NIH a few years ago, and the amount of linoleic that we should get from our diet, provided that the diet is 2,000 calories per day, we really should not have more than about 6 grams of linoleic per day, or for that matter, 4.4 is considered a good level, where the amount of linoleic should be half as much, in other words, 2.22. So 4 grams of linoleic to 2 grams of alpha-linolenic, a ratio of 2 to 1, appears to be the adequate amount. In terms of EPA and DHA, 650 milligrams to 1,000 per day, with the DHA being at least 220 milligrams. During pregnancy, it is absolutely important that the pregnant woman, and also during lactation, she has at least 220 to 300 milligrams of DHA, and that the infant formula should contain about 0.35% of fatty acids should be DHA, and 0.5 should be arachidonic acid. This is actually the amount that is found now in infant formulas that are enriched with omega-3 fatty acids, DHA, which is essential for visual function and normal development of the brain, and 0.5% of arachidonic acid, which is important for normal growth. Thank you.